other papers, precursor papers, which have now been published in journals, and I'll refer to those a little bit as we go through. So this is going to be a stylized So we'll start with an understatement, income, interest in income, financial wealth, and consumption inequality has increased in the last decade. My key question is the second bullet here. Can monetary policy be conducted in a way that benefits all households, even if you have a lot of heterogeneity? So we're going to construct an artificial world where there is a lot of heterogeneity, and monetary policy that I'm going to suggest is going to actually be good for everybody, even though there are lots of different people. Some are very rich and some are very poor. Some are young, some are old. And so that's going to be my story here. Part of this has been because as a policymaker, I've been hit with all kinds of different audiences over the last decade, and they're all telling me different things about what we're doing to the income and wealth distribution. Some people say we're skewing it one way. Some people say we're skewing it the other way. So, you know, here we have a stylized, precise description, although ridiculously abstract description of what's going on. And so I want to convey this point across that we can conduct monetary policy in a way that would help everybody. So what we're going to do here is construct a stylized economy with considerable wealth, income, consumption, inequality. So we're going to hit all the dimensions of inequality that we usually talk about in the literature. By the way, this is the only slide you have to pay attention to. You just skip the rest of the stuff. So this is the main argument. So it's a stylized economy. It's math econ. Without any equations in this particular version. So if you want to see all the math, go to the paper. The role of monetary policy is going to be to make sure that private credit markets are working well. They'll be complete markets. And then optimal monetary policy is going to look like nominal GDP targeting, that is countercyclical price level movements. So in that sense, this paper would have something to say about the framework discussion that's going on at the Fed during 2019. It would have a recommended policy to the extent that you believe this particular model. And this nominal GDP targeting is still optimal even if you put in this massive heterogeneity the way I'm going to describe it here. That is, there's going to be enough heterogeneity here to get the Gini coefficients almost right for the U.S. economy. So we'll get to that as I get further through this talk. So the main result is that nominal GDP targeting constitutes optimal monetary policy for the masses in this particular environment, and we can talk about the merits and demerits of this particular environment, whether you like it or not. I'm inspired by these papers that are around in the literature right now. For those of you that don't pay much attention to this, these are kind of frontier papers that are being discussed a lot in the monetary policy world. They have a lot of heterogeneity. They have some kind of monetary and fiscal policy cycle economies were studied by Viglianti in particular, but many others, a long tradition in literature. So that's going to mean that there are young and old people simultaneously living in this economy. Each period, a new cohort of households will come in and enter the economy. We're going to think about those guys being sort of age 20. Any age in that range will do. They're going to live for 241 periods. It's going to be a quarterly model. Then they're going to exit the economy. And we get hung up on, a lot of times when you talk about overlapping generations, people start talking about being born and dying and stuff like that. I think that you just want to think about it as, this is the group we're going to keep track of, sort of 20-year-olds to 80-year-olds. We're not going to keep track of children. We're not going to keep track of the extremely old. We're going to just keep track of that group in there. Those are the primary decision makers in the economy. And then households are going to have very simple log preferences over consumption and leisure, so they're going to decide how much to consume and work. And the critical feature of this particular version of this model is that households are randomly assigned one of many possible personal productivity profiles on the end of the model. I'm going to show you some pictures of this. So you're going to be age 20, and I'm going to hand you a productivity profile for your entire life about how productive you're going to be at all the different stages of your life. This productivity profile is going to, in a brilliant stroke of mathematics here, we're going to make this productivity profile exactly symmetric. It's going to begin low, it's going to hit the peak right at the very middle point in the life cycle, and it's going to decline in the same way it rose up. What that's going to do is give us tremendous tractability in this particular version of the model. In fact, we'll be able to solve this model with pencil and paper methods in the appendix. So what's great about that is almost all this other literature can't talk about that. They're not sure what the equilibrium is. They have to approximate it numerically. This makes everything very cumbersome. Here we've got paper and pencil solutions. That's why I'm going to show you nice pictures and show you everything that's going on. So we buy a lot of tractability with this set of symmetry assumptions. You can take your productivity units and sell them on the market at a competitive wage. So if I have a lot of productivity units, I'm going to get a lot of income. You don't have very many productivity units, you're not going to get very much income in that particular period. Plus, we can also decide how much to work. There is an aggregate shock. It is the growth rate of aggregate productivity in this economy. So it's just the one shock. So for those of you that are students in here, what's really hard about this kind of problem is you have the aggregate shock, you have the heterogeneous households. The equilibrium means you have to keep track of the whole distribution and how the distribution is moving around over time. But because we made these simplifying assumptions, all going to be really, really clean, and you're going to be able to see how all of that works. No population growth here. Demographics are certainly a big issue, but we're not going to talk about that here. We're not going to talk about effective lower bound here either. That's in a companion paper that's forthcoming in the JEDC. All right, so household credit. So basically what's going to go on in this economy is that there's going to be a large private credit market that's going to be essential to how the economy works. They're going to be middle-aged people who want to save for their retirement years, and there are also young people who want to pull consumption forward in the life cycle. This is standard in life cycle models, so this creates a big private credit market. That's the big market that's going on in this economy. This is privately issued household debt. So the young people are issuing some debt to the middle-aged people, which they're going to repay in the future.
state contingent aspect means that real resources are misallocated via this friction. Theory tells you that everything should be state contingent. These are non-state contingent. The other part is that they're nominally denominated, and since the central bank is going to control the price level here, the central bank might be able to fix the fact that those these contracts are out there. So I'm fascinated by non-state contingent nominal contracting as a friction. Usually when we're writing models like this down, we do sticky price frictions, and certainly following the work of Michael Woodford and many others, that's been a dominant paradigm. As we're going to see, some of the policy recommendations that come out of here with this friction are not that different from what you would get from the sticky price type of models, and in that sense, I think it's an interesting, some interesting results here. So there's a critical timing protocol that's typical in these models. Nature moves first. They tell us the growth rate of aggregate productivity. Policymaker gets to move second, gets to choose the price level directly. We're skipping money demand and all that stuff. That's in another paper. So you just choose the price level directly here. So if you could choose it, what would you choose it to be? Then households get to choose how much they want to consume and save for that particular period and out into and their consumption savings plans out into the future. So what's going to happen is that the monetary policymaker is going to follow a nominal GDP targeting rule that delivers this complete market allocations. And I credit my colleague, Evan Koenig, at the Dallas Fed for being one of the earliest voices for this type of nominal GDP targeting in this context, and also Kevin Sheedy in the Brookings Papers in 2014 recommending nominal GDP targeting. So what's going to happen is that if the policymaker follows this particular policy rule for sure and with complete credibility for all time, then households are going to consume equal amounts of available production conditional on their productivity. That's called equity share contracting. So if we all have the same productivity profile, but we're at different stages of the life cycle, what would happen is we'd borrow money in just the right way, so we split the economic pie exactly equally among us for that particular period. Then we go to the next period, total size of the pie would change a little bit, but we'd again split the entire pie evenly among all of us. That's called equity share contracting. That's a claim to first best contracting under homothetic preferences, which we have here. So what the nominal GDP targeting rule is doing is providing some insurance for all households against future aggregate shocks. Everything's going to bounce around. This is a stochastic economy, but everything's going to be proportional to the real wage. As the real wage bounces around, it gets higher and higher over time. The equilibrium, I'm almost at pictures here. The equilibrium in this economy has a really nice feature, and this is because of the simplifying assumptions that we've made. But the real interest rate in the economy is exactly equal to the output growth rate in the economy every single day, even in the stochastic economy. So you can guess and verify the solution here. So you could think of this as a so-called Wechselian natural rate of interest would be the growth rate of the economy. This is just like in a New Keynesian model. In the New Keynesian model, you have the sticky price friction. You have this natural Wechselian natural rate of interest, and the policymaker's job is to find that Wechselian natural rate and get the real rate of interest to equal that Wechselian natural rate. Once you do that, you get the best allocation resources that you can get in that economy. The same thing is going on here. The policymaker's nominal GDP targeting rule is helping you attain the Wechselian natural rate. So this is about, let's talk about these life cycle productivity profiles. This is kind of what's different about this particular version of the model. And let's talk about where all of the heterogeneity comes from. So these households enter the economy. These are 20-year-old recruits coming into the economy, into the decision-making part of their life, the economic decision-making part of their life. And they're going to draw a scaling factor from a uniform distribution, and they're going to get a scaled version of a baseline that you can predict a lot of lifetime earnings by knowing characteristics of 20-year-olds. About 60 to 70% of all future variance in earnings can be predicted knowing characteristics of people at age 20. So we're going to do an extreme version of this where the only uncertainty that you face is which productivity profile you're going to get at age 20. There's no uncertainty after that. So there's no idiosyncratic risk after that point. You could think that there was shocks after, even after you got your productivity profile, there'd be idiosyncratic risk. Maybe you're going to be unemployed some days, but there's some kind of insurance market that's taking care of that. So the only thing that's really happening at the individual level is that you've got, you're just handed this productivity profile at age 20, and you can't do anything about it. Now, we're also going to look at log normal distribution for this. This is chosen from a uniform distribution, so there's going to be some high guy. I'm going to use Tom Brady and Giselle. They're going to be at the top. And then there's going to be a low guy, I'll say that's me. I'm at the low end. And there's going to be uniform distribution, so you're going to get one of those possible productivity profiles. But you could also do log normal, so you could push them arbitrarily close to zero and way out to infinity. You could have arbitrarily rich and poor people in this economy, so you could even accommodate Elon Musk in this particular framework. So here's our baseline productivity profile, just to get the hang of these pictures, because I'm going to show you a lot of pictures here that are going to be elaborate versions of this. This goes from 0 to 240. You live for 241 quarters from age 20 to age 80, and you're more productive in the middle period of life than you are at the beginning of life or the end of life, and the ratio of middle of life to beginning and end is about 50% higher. This actually isn't too different from what's out there in the empirical research. We're not claiming that this is exactly the right one, but it helps us with the math to use this particular one. Now, a lot of these pictures, it's best to think of them as a cross-section of, you could think of this as your own life. This is how productive you are as you go through the life cycle. But you could also just look at it as a cross-section of what's going on at every point in time. So there's somebody who just came into the economy there over there on the left. There's somebody at the middle of the life cycle. They're right in the middle. There's somebody right at the end of the life cycle. So this is also a cross-section and might be a better way to interpret this. Okay, now you do these draws, and you might get a multiple of that baseline profile, or you might get a fraction of that baseline profile, and you're going to scale up up and down, and you get this entire mass of people with different amounts of human capital is the way to think about this, or the different amounts of life cycle productivity. Again, this is with a uniform distribution. You could do a log normal, and this would trail off to infinity on the high side and get arbitrarily close on the low side. We're not doing that in this picture because that's hard to draw. So this is the uniform version. What's going to be interesting is you would think that that log normal distribution would drive those Gini coefficients really, really high. That isn't what happens. There are limits to what happens with the Gini coefficients. So I'll show you that as we go along. Another thing about this picture is it looks like the guy at the bottom has a very flat productivity profile, and the guy at the top, Giselle, and has a very pronounced productivity profile. That's not true. That's an optical illusion here. Everybody has the same pattern of productivity over their life cycle. They're just scaled up and down. All right, so what happens in this equilibrium here? Well, the first thing that happens is, again, because of our simplifying assumptions, everyone's going to work the same amount at different points in the life cycle, whether they're rich or they're poor. So Giselle is going to work just as much as me at the same age. Okay? So this is what's meant to be shown in this picture. Again, this is a best viewed as a cross-section. These are all the different people that are alive at a particular date. The 0-1 represents the amount of the total time that you have every quarter. How much of that are you going to devote to the labor market? And the this is the mass of labor income. So again, you're more productive in the middle of life and you work more. So labor income goes way up in the middle of life. And so here you've got the continuum of agents at every cohort, so the same number of agents in some sense, but of course very little income being earned early in the life cycle or later in the life cycle, a lot of income being earned in the middle of the life cycle. Ratios here are about 42 to 1 or something like that between the richest guy and the poorest guy. Again, you could do this in a log normal sense and you'd have going off to infinity. We're going to calculate the Gini coefficient for this blob here, and it's going to be very close to the U.S. data. And then what do people actually do under this optimal monetary policy? The blue is the income, labor income. The red is the consumption. So again, people that are sharing the same productivity profile all consume the same amount. So the people that are at the very top of this blue part of the diagram here, they're consuming at the very top of the red box there. So what they're doing is completely splitting the available production among that group. So the way to think about this is you have a young doctor, middle-aged doctor, old doctor. The middle-aged doctor is earning a ton of income. The younger and older doctors aren't earning very much. They're all consuming exactly the same amount. This is the way the credit market is working in this economy. So the red box then will be total consumption of the economy. Some people are consuming very little because they're way low in this box. And we're going to calculate the Gini coefficient for that guy, too. And then here's net asset holdings, my favorite picture. Again, this is best interpreted as a cross-section from the people that are just entering the economy on the left to the people that are exiting on the right. People at the middle of the life cycle have no net assets. This is net asset holding. The hump on the right is the people that are saving for retirement. Quarter number 180 corresponds about to age 65. Quarter number 60 corresponds about to age 35. So that on the left-hand side, they're getting maximally indebted because, you know, they're trying to pull consumption forward in the life cycle. And this is, you know, very akin to buying a house or something like that, trying to pull consumption services forward in the life cycle. Then they start decumulating the debt and accumulating assets up to a peak at about age 65, and then they run that down as they get toward the end of the life cycle. The right-hand blue object has to be equal to the left-hand blue object because it's a closed economy and the amount of borrowing and lending has to be equal in this economy. When you're thinking about the financial wealth genie, it's going to be just the right-hand side of this figure. That's how it's usually calculated in the data because it's who has positive financial assets in the economy. Those are people that are saving for retirement. All right, so now there are three notions of income. Then I'll get to some stuff about other stuff, about policy. Monetary policy. I'll get to that in a minute here. So you could think about three notions now of income. There's the labor income. I already showed you the labor income distribution in this economy. So you just look at that and calculate a Gini coefficient for that. That's not the way it's always done in the data because usually we count labor income plus any capital income that you'd have from your savings. So you can look at that. And then you could look at the non-negative component of total income. So some people are spending more than they're earning because they're going further and further into debt at part of the, financial wealth, it's very high for the U.S., about 80%. So if we look at the model itself, there's a lot of heterogeneity. It depends on life cycle productivity. It depends also on the dispersion parameter. Financial wealth would be the non-negative part of net assets. We can do log normal productivity, which would have arbitrarily rich and poor households. We can calculate all this with pencil and paper here. So here's what you get. The U.S. data is across the top in this picture. There's the 80, the 51 for the income, and the 32 for consumption. If we select from a uniform distribution for these life cycle productivity profiles, we get consumption Gini just about right, income Gini just about right, wealth Gini a little bit too small. You might think that that would be fixed with the log normal choice, because the log normal choice would have this long tail, and you'd have Elon Musk in there and other billionaires, but no. Log normal wealth Gini actually comes out slightly lower than the uniform Gini, but it's the same on income and consumption. But the point of this is probably not to take it too far as a calibration exercise, because it doesn't have enough other features, but it shows you with this very simple construct that you can start to get real close to the amount of inequality that's in the U.S. data. It's well known that this type of model is not going to get the full wealth Gini the way it is in the U.S. data. You might say, gee, Jim, you could just increase that dispersion parameter and push that out, and I can go to infinity, actually. That actually doesn't help us get the Gini coefficients, which is what this picture shows, that the horizontal axis is the scaling parameter on relative to the baseline productivity profile. How far out are you going to spread these guys? A value of 1 would mean everybody gets the baseline profile. There is no difference in lifetime productivity for anybody. And this picture is kind of instructive here. We chose a value of 6.5 on the horizontal axis, so we got these Gini coefficients. The wealth Gini, 72, the blue line, 51, the green line, consumption Gini, 32. But we could have chose 4, and we would have gotten just about the same numbers. We, in fact, could have chose 2, and we would have gotten just about the same numbers. And look all the way on the left there. You go all the way down to 1. So with a 1, everybody would be getting exactly the same productivity profile. There'd be no difference between life cycle productivity between any of us. But wait a minute, you still get labor income Gini not too far from 0.5, and the wealth Gini not too far from 0.65 or 0.6 or something like that. You actually get a lot just from the life cycle alone. And of course, the consumption Gini would go down to 0. Because everyone consumes the same amount at different stages of the life cycle. Regardless of where they're in the life cycle. But as far as the income and wealth Gini, they would actually be quite high. So some of you have heard me before say that life cycle alone would give you quite a bit of the measured income and wealth Gini. This is showing exactly that on the far left part of this picture. It won't give you the consumption Gini. Maybe I should talk policy a little bit here. What is this nominal GDP targeting, and what is this crazy stuff, and how can we relate it back? setting the price level every single quarter that directly. So what does this mean in terms of interest rates? And we can talk in terms of interest rates because they're implicit in the way this economy works is the nominal interest, how the nominal interest rate evolves. So what's going on in this economy is because you have this one period ahead nominal contracting, people have to meet in a market. We would all meet in a market. Some of us would be borrowers and lenders. We're going to agree on a nominal interest rate. And what is that nominal interest rate going to be? It's going to be the expected rate of nominal GDP growth in this economy because we've set up the simplifying assumptions to make it be exactly that. So the expected rate of nominal GDP growth, well, that's something I can get my head around. And then the policy is to say the next period, the policymaker is going to ratify whatever nominal interest rate all of us agreed upon last period coming into this period, no matter what the shock was in the economy. By having that policy, that's going to make the real rate of interest equal to the Wick-Sellian natural rate of interest, just like in the simple New Keynesian model. We're always trying to restore the Wick-Sellian natural real rate as part of the optimal monetary policy. Sometimes people ask me, why is this nominal GDP targeting? Well, if the shock process was pure white noise so that the shocks aren't related between periods, if that's all that was going on, then every period, in effect, the policymaker would be putting the economy exactly on a nominal GDP growth path. There'd be a shock every period, but the policymaker would just put you right back on the nominal GDP growth path every single period. That would be perfect nominal GDP targeting. If there's persistence in aggregate productivity growth, it's going to swing back and forth, and you would hit the nominal GDP growth path on average over a longer period of time, but it would still be characterized as nominal GDP targeting. So that's the sense in which we're calling it nominal GDP targeting. But I think the biggest point for me is that nominal and real rates fall in recession in this economy. We've got that in this next picture here. So this shows what actually happens when you start in steady state and now there's a shock and it's a bad day. Technology growth has been low. So that's the upper left box in this picture. The red dotted line is the date of the shock. So you're expecting 2% growth in this picture, but actual growth came in at zero. So it's a bad day for the economy. And then the technology is going to revert back to mean slowly over time going forward. These are quarters in this picture. So what the what the policymaker does is in this upper right box, the nominal interest rate there. Let's go to the inflation picture though on the bottom right. In the period of the shock, you had a bad shock, so what did you do? You set the price level high that particular day so that the nominal rate is unchanged. That's classic nominal GDP targeting, absolutely classic. You have a bad day, you set the price level high. You have a good day, you set the price level low so that the nominal path stays the same. So that's what you do in the period of the shock, and then after that, you lower the inflation rate, and then you return to mean. That's what's going on in the lower right box. If you look at the nominal interest rate itself, which is in the upper right box, it stays the same in the period of the shock. That's because the policy is to ratify the contracted nominal rate. And then it falls in subsequent periods and then goes back to steady state. So if you look at the big picture here of this, the recession comes, what do? You lower the nominal interest rate in the period after the shock. Looks a lot like what actual policy does, because usually we can't react fast enough to lower the policy rate in anticipation of the shock. All right. So that's meant to convince you that it's not a completely crazy policy. So let me summarize what I've got here, and I'll be happy to take questions and talk about this in more detail. So the guts of this is to say that actual households have peak earning as they continue nominal contracting friction, the monetary authority can fix this by using nominal GDP targeting. Doing so restores a Weakselian natural rate of interest, which would be the rate of interest, the real rate of interest that would occur in this economy if there were no frictions at all and everything worked perfectly. The key about this paper is that this policy works well for all households in the economy, young and old, rich and poor, because they all face a life cycle consumption smoothing problem. So, are you reallocating income between different people in the economy? Yeah, you are, but you're doing it in a way that everybody, you know, at least in principle, would approve of, because you're getting just the right interest rate all the time, and therefore we're calling this optimal monetary policy for the masses. So I often get the question, hey Jim, does monetary policy affect inequality? Well, if you had bad monetary policy here, then what you'd have is incomplete markets. And if you had incomplete markets, which you surely do in the real world, but if you had incomplete markets, then this credit market wouldn't be working as nicely as it is here, and some people would be winning and some people would be losing from you know, the shocks that are hitting the economy and the way the credit market is allocating resources. So relative to that, from going from the incomplete markets world, bringing in the nominal GDP targeting, and therefore making the credit market work perfectly, you're going to improve consumption allocations, you're going to alter the asset holding distribution from what it would otherwise be, you're going to alter the income distribution by altering all hours work from what they would otherwise be. So all of these things are going on in this economy, but my point would be this can be done in a way that benefits all households because you're making the credit market, which is a great force for reallocating income inside in the economy voluntarily through voluntary trade, you're making that work very well. So this is a whirlwind tour of this paper. Again, it is available online, and I would see it as a contribution to the framework review that this is being conducted this year by the Federal Reserve. This is a complicated and abstract model, but one that I think helps clarify our thinking about what the heck is going on. And I think there are very pragmatic, simple versions of this that would get at the same issues here, which have the flavor of price level targeting. You wouldn't want to miss your inflation target to the low side many years in a row, as we have just done in the Fed. You want to hit the inflation target on average. You would have history-dependent policies so that periods of misses on the low side would be offset by periods of misses on the high side. This would cement expectations in just the right way. So there are pragmatic versions of what's in this paper. This gives an argument about why this might be good policy. That's a little bit different from what you'd see in the new Keynesian literature. So I hope this is interesting. I'm